Hello, and welcome to Season 3 of Medical Women Talking. I'm Jane Dacre, and in this season, I wanted to speak to more wonderful and inspiring medical women, including people who are early and mid-career. These women are all making a name for themselves in their respective fields. They're what I like to call rising stars and will be influencing all our futures.
Parveen is a pharmaceutical physician and a former surgeon. So thank you very much for joining me today. So Parveen, we're going to be talking about your career. So can we start by you giving me a summary of your career so far? How did you get to where you are?
Thank you, Prof. Dacre. Thank you also for having me here today. It's a brilliant series from what you're telling me and from what other people have told me. So I am a pharmaceutical physician. I trained in medicine, like a number of people are going through med school at the minute. Did my training, did my specialty training, trained as a general and vascular surgeon. Managed to get a training number in London, which used to be scarce in those days. So I was very proud of myself and I loved it. I loved every minute of it, working at Mary's, even in ITU, because in those days they made you do ITU. So doing 6 months of ITU was fun and learned a lot. And then life gets in the way, right? You have all these amazing dreams to be a surgeon, work in trauma centres, and then you start your family. And then if you're also married to a surgeon, as I am, it gets in the way a bit and you think, oh, how do I manage both? So when I had my son, who is now 9 years old, I had to make that choice. I went back after maternity leave, tried my hardest with childcare, nannies, because neither of our parents live nearby. And it just wasn't working. And at that point, I had to sort of stop and pause for a few minutes, a few weeks, actually, make it sound like it was a quick decision and say, OK, what is my priority now? Love my career. That, you know, that is without saying. But I also have my son as a priority. So how do I manage this? You know, what do we do? And at that point, I'd already started my MBA, which wasn't actually fashionable in the NHS those days, although now I see that a lot more doctors are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd already started on that sort of learning about business, that commercial journey. And I thought, okay, one of the reasons that I wanted to do medicine in the first place was to have sort of an impact on healthcare, but also improve patient outcomes. If I can no longer do that at a local level, because I've got my son RG as a priority as well, how do I do that?
Yeah. Can I just ask you about the decision? So often it's the case that dual medical families have their first child and a choice is made. But the choice is usually that the woman plays second fiddle. And their career changes and the man carries on. And if you read Claudia Goldin's book, I don't know whether you've seen that, the Nobel laureate, she talks about greedy work that sucks people in, and the people that can be sucked in to excessive hours are men because they don't feel the same responsibility for childcare. Is that what happened to you?
So we had a very long discussion, my husband and I, and my husband is, he's an academic surgeon, he's a clinician scientist, and he really loved sort of academic research coupled with surgery. I was passionate about surgery, I really loved that, and I always knew that I needed a second bow to me, and what would that be? I didn't really want to do a PhD at that point. So I was really looking at, okay, and hence why I started the MBA of, okay, I can be a surgeon and work to support management, you know, make it a bit better environment and have actually medics leading and being in senior clinical leadership positions to ensure that the front line is supported, that the front line is listened to. So actually that was one of the reasons I started my MBA and thought, okay, maybe I could do that track. But life gets in the way. I remember
So did you, when you started your MBA, were you still working full time?
Yeah. I was working as a registrar. I think I was year six, I think. I started it, working full-time, doing the MBA, because it was an executive MBA, doing it in the evenings, doing it weekends when I wasn't on call, you know, doing the assignments in my own spare time. Not that you had much spare time in those days, but I did it. I managed to do it. Because I was very passionate that I wanted to make sure that whatever I did within the NHS at that point, I had the credibility and the knowledge for. That's what I was always passionate, that foundation. And unfortunately, when I was looking at, okay, what else can I do? Opportunities were offered. And again, I am not saying anything against breast surgeons, but the opportunity was offered. Okay, go and retrain to be a breast surgeon. And I was like, you know, before I made the decision of vascular or breast, there was a reason I went to vascular. I loved the pace of it. I loved the trauma. I loved the sick patients. And I'm not saying breast cancer patients aren't sick, but that type of surgery, as great as it is, didn't always excite me as much as the vascular side. And maybe if I'd made that different decision, I'd still be a surgeon. So, you know, but I didn't. So I didn't take the opportunity to go back and retrain. My husband wouldn't be able to, like, sort of leave. He is one of those core archetypes that is NHS through and through, a medic through and through. He loves his patients. So it wasn't a matter of like, oh, my career is inferior. And we never looked at it like that. Because I don't have that victim approach. I always say, okay, I've got a choice to make. I made the decision in the first place to be a vascular surgeon. I also made a decision to have my son, who I love, and I wouldn't have changed that. So what is the next decision I have to make? And that's why I always look at it as not as a challenge, but okay, it might be challenging to go through that period, but what is the opportunity? What can I make out of this? And hence why I departed. And the first departure I made into consulting wasn't a very successful one.
Okay, so you decided you were offered a job in breast surgery and you thought, actually, no, I want to do something different. So you is that when you went into the pharmaceutical industry then?
So I was finishing off and I went first into consulting, life science consulting. Because I was like, okay, I don't know which is the next best industry to go into. Let me try. And an opportunity came to join Simon Kucher & Partners and understand the life science sector, because they will work for multiple pharmaceutical companies to help them address a problem. So I went and worked there for about a year before I got approached to go and work at Novartis. And that was my first step into the pharmaceutical world. Artists, I learned so much, great people, great culture, and I loved it because you were able to work with a product right from phase two, phase three, depending on your role, to get it all the way through regulatory approval, which in those days were EMA, and then through NICE reimbursement. And it was so much learning. But what was really nice was that I was able to bring my clinical skill sets, my clinical acumen, and get them to put themselves in the shoes of the stakeholder, their biggest stakeholder, which is the NHS.
Okay.
And get them to... Sorry.
How long did you did that for how long?
So I was at Novartis, and this again is probably going to be different to people at the NHS. I was at Novartis for a year and a half, nearly 2 years, before I went to another pharmaceutical company called Otsuka, a Japanese company.
Did you get headhunted from one to the other? So how does that happen?
So you look at, so when you, and this is probably a bit foreign to like, and it was definitely foreign to me when I was in the NHS. To progress in the pharmaceutical industry, you can either do it within the company or you can look for opportunities externally. And it's also looking at, okay, what do I need next? What do I need in my skill sets next? And I was always very conscious of the fact that I'd started later in the pharmaceutical industry. I was a lot older than a lot of my peers. So I needed, in my own head, I needed to climb quicker. Again, making sure I had the competencies, but making sure I was able to get to a level that I was comfortable with. So an opportunity came to be, because when I entered Novartis, I was level one. I was a medical advisor starting again. And then an opportunity came to join Otsuka, Japanese company, great company, to be one of the medical affairs managers. And because of the work that I did with them, I got promoted to be their medical director. And then my world opened up to being able to look after not just UK and Ireland, but Central Eastern Europe markets. I didn't even know what was going on in those markets, but I had great teams. We were able to build sort of stronger teams and learn. And that, I think, has been my great thing, is like, if you're always open to learning, you can always make any sort of challenge or barrier that may come in your way as an opportunity.
Can I, you're in an unusual position in being able to compare the NHS as a learning environment and industry as a learning environment. So do they compare? Is the support that you get different? How is it different?
It is very different. In the NHS, when I was training, it was ARCPs. I'm sure we still do those.
Yeah, we do.
Those annual reviews, plus you always had your mini kexes and all of that jazz. But no one ever sits you down and go, okay, let's do your personal development. What does personal development look like for you? No one sits down because everyone is super busy. And maybe sometimes an excuse, I don't know, but nobody sits you down and says, okay, have you got your personal development plan? What does that look like? What does your development look like to you? What does it mean to you? And where do you want to ultimately get? How do we help you on that track? You don't have those conversations. Even in the ARCPs, it was more about, okay, have you done your competencies for this year? Have you done your number of cases? Where are you tracking? Where would you like to go next? You know, what do you think you're missing from your sort of surgical skill sets? So that's a very big difference in pharma that I've noticed, is that, and there's variations of how pharmaceutical companies will do it. You know, a huge mix of some do it exceptionally well, some are still learning and they're growing. But that's one of the things that you always will sit down and do with the people that work in your team, is saying, okay, you're in this role. What does this role and the development look like for you in this role? What do you want to get out of it? Because what we've learned over the years is, if you really invest in a person's development, they will give you 110, 120%.
And do you think that, I mean, the inference is that maybe we're not investing in people enough in the NHS? Is that?
I think there's a lot of investment given to the NHS, but it's, you know, now I'm an outsider, right? Sometimes it's really difficult to see where it's going. Is it really going to the front line? Is it really going to the nurses, the doctors, the sort of allied health professionals, to make them feel, to upskill them in the way that they want to be upskilled, supported the way that they want to be supported? I don't see that. And I'm not saying it's not happening. It's just that's not visible from a person on the outside.
Very interesting. So it can't all have been a bed of roses, though, in the pharmaceutical industry. Tell me about some highs and some lows.
Oh, no, it's never a bed of roses. And that's one of the when you leave, you know, there's always people who reach out to you over the years who are looking for alternative careers or just someone to talk to. And the great myth that always comes across is, oh, you only work 9 to 5. I was like, I've never worked 9 to 5 in the pharmaceutical industry. I said, my job starts from literally the first email I read, depending on who I'm working for at that point. And if it's a UK role, if it's a European or an international role, because you have to be available when the markets are open. So, you know, it's definitely not a 9 to 5 job. And with that also comes a balancing act, and learning sort of the business language. I think that has been one of my biggest learning points, is we can apply the science, but being able to articulate the science to internal stakeholders so that they understand the value that this asset can bring, but equally be able to articulate that externally so that the clinicians who would potentially use this asset, these drugs, can understand why, what the benefit it can bring to their patient group.
So I think it still might be difficult for people to get their head around, what do you actually do?
Okay, so I work in the medical affairs department, and medical affairs is sort of a function that does handshakes with R&D. So our research and development will come along and do their sort of phase one or early development, late development, do the phase one, phase two, phase three trials that a lot of the audience will have heard of.
Yeah.
While they're doing that, medical affairs will partner with them to help understand, okay, what value can this drug that's in clinical trials bring to the market that person may be in, or above market? What is a regional benefit? What is a global benefit? What are the barriers sometimes for this drug to get accepted?
Mm-hmm.
Pairing it with the standard of care, or is the market moved on? So that is where medical affairs beautifully come in, to be able to provide those market analysis insights. And then our role is to say, okay, now we're getting these data points out, what does this mean to the clinical community? So then you end up spending a lot of time talking to clinicians like yourself, saying, okay, this is the data, how does it translate into your care? And if it doesn't, what is missing? What is a value gap? Evidence is missing, and then work out how do you generate that evidence.
Okay, so now that's really interesting. So you talked about lows in it not being 9 to 5. Are there other things that are different to the NHS that might be other lows? And then tell me some highs.
So I think your mindset has to shift quite quickly to be able to be focused to deliver value for the business as well as delivering value for the clinical community. And it's always that balancing act that you're always trying to make sure that you do achieve, because primarily you are a clinician at heart, right? So, you know, that I wouldn't describe it as a low. And to be honest, I haven't had, like, I'm not being cheesy here. I haven't had many lows, because for me, I always take it as a learning opportunity. Yes, there might have been challenges when, you know, we have tried to partner with an external community or an external stakeholder, and they haven't had that trust piece. So that mm-hmm. is probably the lows, in that how do you get stakeholders like yourself or the bigger organization, the NHS, and others to really see pharma as that amicable partner.
Yeah. So one of the things that has bothered a lot of people in the NHS, particularly recently, is the way that women are treated, and also the way that women who are not white women are treated. Is that different, or how is that different in pharma?
So they do a lot of work on diversity and inclusion. And yes, okay, at the higher up you get at the board level, there might not be a great representation of women or ethnic women. But pharma, especially from the companies I've worked with, always try to have diversity inclusion as part of their values, because you want to bring people who are competent and capable of doing the roles that they need fulfilled, adding value to the business, but also to the partners that we work with, and bring it back to patients. That doesn't necessarily mean it just has to be a woman, it could be a male, but we do know that boards that have that greater diversity, that women's perspective, have a lot more harmony sometimes than a board that is just full of the same archetype. So what boards are trying to do is mix up the archetypes rather than having every single person on the board the same profile.
Well, I think that works probably everywhere, doesn't it? But not everybody knows that, or not everybody accepts that. So what have been some really good things Tell me about some fantastic achievements, some highs.
What's been great is the acceptance of clinicians into industry. That's been a great high, that they really value the insights that you can bring and are willing to sort of work with you to get you to learn the business side. I think what is also a considerable high is the world is your oyster in pharma. You don't need to just stay in the medical side of the function. There's a lot of people I know who came in through the medical route and are now working as commercial directors or managing the company. You know, so there's a great diversity of career options. I think that's been a great high, being able to work on some of the blockbuster drugs that I've worked on, such as Entresto for heart failure, which was, you know, great. It went against the standard of care. That was great. Others that I've worked on, being able to launch in both simultaneously in early breast cancer and metastatic breast cancer, that was a great high for me because I'm not an oncologist by background. So I had to do a lot of learning very quickly, but I loved it. You know, being able to talk to breast cancer patients, being able to talk to, you know, breast cancer organizations and clinicians to understand how does this asset translate to their care was really beneficial for me. And I learned a lot. So those have been some of my career highs.
Fantastic. You know? And one of the other things that you've talked about a little bit, you talked about having your son, but do you think being a successful woman in pharma has influenced or affected your personal life?
Probably to the better. I have more flexibility around my time. Yes, I have to work hard and we do work very hard, but I have more freedom with my time because I unfortunately, as a clinician working in the NHS, you can't bring your patients home, right? If your child's ill, you have to cancel a clinic or, you know, there's an impact. Whereas if I have to go and pick up my son or something happens, I'm at the best needing to cancel a meeting or not participate and catch up at a later time. You know, so that's had a positive impact on my family. And, you know, the flexibility that and sort of the understanding that the organizations I've worked with has been very beneficial to my family. They've been very supportive. You know, my mum was ill last year and the company was very supportive that I could take the time out and, you know, go and look after her. So, and that, you know, as much as the NHS would love to support its staff, it's not always easy, is it? Because you can't.
Who's going to mind the shop?
Exactly.
That's always a problem, isn't it? Yeah. So for women who are coming through, what advice, just general advice, would you give to women wanting to work in pharma or indeed just wanting to reach leadership positions based on your experience?
So the advice I would give them is, and it's probably easier said than done for some, is don't give up. Take a few steps back, pause and think, okay, what is it that I'm aiming for? What is my North Star? And how do I get there? It doesn't have to be a linear path. It can go up and down. It can go round circles. But take a pause and say, okay, if that's my North Star, how do I get there? And if I can't get there the way I thought I would, what do I do about it? And have those conversations and reflections and don't be the victim. You can get to where you want to get to. You can get into those senior leadership positions and you can make it happen. And have conversations with your family members. Bring them in. Say, look, this is what I want to achieve. What can you do to help me?
Okay, fantastic.
Don't give up because there's always a way.
Very wise advice. So, Parveen, thank you so much for talking to me today.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.